In our trek to Golgotha, we're trying to determine what would cause leading men in both religion and state to premeditatedly plan the assassination of a man of peace. What would be the reasons? Why are the causes? What are the circumstances? And what were the contributing factors that led these otherwise respectable men to assassinate this man of peace, Jesus of Nazareth? We saw his first exposure of their Sabbath practices. And that exposure revealed a misrepresentation of God. Their way of keeping the Sabbath made people think that God was a punitive God, that he was really out to get you, and that you really had to cross every T and dot every I, and you dared not step out of line, and that the Sabbath was a way of his punishing you and making you do certain things that were contrary to you, contrary to your good. And this misrepresentation of God, this misunderstanding of God that they had, caused them to mistreat people. And that's what touched Jesus to the core. Because Jesus came as a fighter for people. If he could be remembered for anything at all, he would want to be remembered as a person who stood up and fought for people. He was a people fighter. And this first exposure that we have to the reaction and the interaction between Jesus and the religious leaders, he exposed the way they misunderstood God and then consequently misinterpreted him, and then people then misconceived of God, and they grew up not knowing God. And as a result, they grew up not knowing how to treat each other. Last Sunday, we saw him rip the mask of hypocrisy off of the leaders of the Jewish religion. In this matter of washings, they were so meticulous in their washings, and they would go through this ceremonial washing. It wasn't just washing their hands to get off the physical dirt. This was a spiritual exercise, a religious exercise that they went through in order to go through and indicate their separateness, which is what the word Pharisee means. They were the separated ones. And if you were going to be a real, true, orthodox, genuine to the core Jew, you had to go through this custom of washing your hands. And Jesus just ripped that mask off and let them see that their outer washings had very little to do with their inner self. Their inner reality was corrupt. They were correct on the outside and corrupt on the inside. Now, Jesus wasn't opposed to external ritual. He himself established two of them, baptism and then this memorial feast. He was the one that started them. We didn't have anything to do with either one of them. He started the memorial feast, and he started baptism. I say he started it. He continued along in the same train. John the Baptist came baptizing. But Jesus commanded it to be to all the world. So he wasn't against outside ritual. What Jesus was so opposed to was external ritual that was not accompanied by internal righteousness. External ritual divorced from internal purity was an abomination in his eyes. He more strongly resisted this contradiction, this dichotomy. He so strongly resisted it because it defeated the very purpose of men and what religion is supposed to be. Religion and external ritual is supposed to say to God, I'm yours. I'm yours inside and out, heart, soul, mind, and strength. And no amount of outside washing is going to accomplish that. You've got to be born of the Spirit of God as well as born of water. Well, today we're going to look at another point at which Jesus clashed with the established authorities. And it was over the matter of sin and sinners. Sin and sinners. Now, it seems strange that we might think, you know, surely they could get together on this. Because the Pharisees certainly were opposed to sin. Jesus was opposed to sin. Surely, if there were ever any common ground, they could find it in this issue of sin and sinners. Wrong. They didn't find it there for two or three reasons. We're going to just notice one of them today. We're going to look at his attitude towards sinners. I want to give you a backdrop. I found it in just reading, and it occurred to me. And don't, God gives wisdom to those that ask. And I'm just thankful that this became apparent. In John, the 7th chapter, this was about, this took place in October, AD 28. In October AD 28, in the little village of Nazareth, Israel, his brothers were on their way to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. And as they were leaving the house, they said to Jesus, "Come on and go with us. If you're doing all these things that you claim to be doing, let the whole world see it so that they can believe on you. Nobody who wants to be known publicly does these things in private. Come on and go with us." Jesus said, "No, my time isn't yet here." He said, "Your time is always here." He said, "The world can't hate you, but it hates me." And I want you to notice what he said next, because it represents his attitude toward what the religious leaders were doing. He said, "Their deeds are evil." Evil. Now that's in, look at John 7 and 7, just to make sure that you understand, this was what he thought about it. It was not that their deeds were inappropriate. He didn't say that their deeds were inadequate. He didn't say that their deeds were irrelevant. He just simply said their deeds are evil. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify that what it does is evil. Now, the world here he's talking about is not the whole world. He's talking about this body of people to whom he directed his ministry. And he said, their deeds are evil. And he served notice that what the religious people in Jerusalem were doing to the Hebrew nation, to the Jewish nation, they were evil. They were evil. Now, in this same chapter, his brothers left him in Nazareth. After they left, then he also went up, but he went in disguise. How he did it, I'm not sure. But he put on something that disguised himself so that the people wouldn't recognize him. And he went up and just sainted around among the Jewish pilgrims who were there for that feast. And then toward the last of the feast, he appears in the temple courts and begins to speak. The authorities hear that he's there. They were searching for him. "Do you think he's going to come? Where is this man?" And then somebody said, "He's over there in the temple teaching." And they sent soldiers over there to arrest him. The soldiers got there and they were stunned by what he was saying. And they stood there, their weapons dropped to their sides. They were disarmed. And they came back empty-handed. And when they got back to the authorities, look at verses 47 through 49 of chapter 7. Same chapter. This was about 10 days later. This was toward the middle of October, A.D. 28. About 10 days after they had left from Nazareth, had come to Jerusalem. Now here was this event. And it says, "Finally the temple guards went back to the chief priests and Pharisees, who asked him, 'Why didn't you bring him in?' And they said, 'No one ever spoke like this man. You mean he has deceived you also?' The Pharisees retorted, 'Has any of them of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him?' 'No. But this ignorant mob,'" it says here, "this mob who knows nothing about the law, has a curse on them." Now there's an example of how disrespectful they were to the common people. This ignorant mob, this mob that knows nothing about the law, they have a curse on them. That represents the two irreversible positions that these two people had taken. Jesus said, these men, their works are evil. The men said, as they were speaking about Jesus' influence on the people, they said of these people, these ignorant people who don't know anything about the law, they have a curse on them. Well, those are the two positions. Who were these ignorant people? Who was this ignorant mob that they were talking about? I'd like to just point out two things. First of all, notice that people who usually disregard people like that and who put themselves up on a pedestal of knowing so much and of speaking disparagingly of other people who don't know as much, usually they end up, sooner or later, barking at each other and snipping and biting at each other. Listen to what happened in this seventh chapter of John again. Look at verse 52. When Nicodemus, now, at this point, when the soldiers had returned, and then the ruler of the synagogue, or the ruler of the Pharisees, said, "No, but this mob that knows nothing of the law, there's a curse on them." Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier, remember, by night, and who was one of their own number, said, "Does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what he is doing?" Listen to this man who answered him. They replied, "Are you from Galilee too?" Now, they weren't asking for his geographical origination. They were saying, if you translate this into something that translates, "You dumb bunny, you idiot, you ignoramus," that's what he meant, "are you from Galilee too?" They had the same attitude that Nathanael, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And for him, for these knowledgeable Jewish leaders to spin around and say, are you from Galilee too? Search the scriptures and you'll see that no prophet comes out of Galilee. Oh, there was that barb where they just literally ate each other up. Look over again in chapter 11 of John, and you'll find them there fighting among themselves when the pressure really got heavy and the heat got hot. John chapter 11 and verse 49. Listen to them turn on themselves again. Verse 45, "Therefore many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. Some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done." Now listen to this dumb thing. "Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. 'What are we accomplishing?' they said. 'Here's this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.' Then one of them, named Caiaphas," and he was the lead one, "spoke up and said, 'You know nothing at all.'" My goodness, can't he speak more gentle than that? Is there no way to correct a fellow than to say, "You dumb bunny, you know nothing at all. You don't understand that it's better for one man to die for the whole nation than the whole nation perish." But my cow, there's a way of saying it without just jumping down his throat. And man alive, oh, you'll see another example of it in a minute. But there were two classes of people ignorant mob. There were two classes of people. Number one, there were respectable families. Now, we're trying to find out who it is that were the ignorant mob that the Pharisees felt so separate from. Some of them were respectable families. Think some of them. There was the Lazarus family in Bethany. Mary and Martha and Lazarus. The Lazarus family, they were one of those respectable families. They were, we don't have any direct indication that they were synagogue worshipers, but I don't doubt one whit but what they were true, orthodox, kosher, religious people of that day, the Lazarus family. And then there was the family in Cana of Galilee, whose daughter married, back in John 2 it's mentioned. And they were a kosher Jewish family. You know how you know? You know the six stone water jars that were there holding about 180 gallons of water? That was for Jewish purification. That was so they could come in and do this ceremonial cleansing. They were kosher. They were orthodox Jewish people. So you've got people in Bethany. You've got people in Cana. You've got, who else were some other examples? Mark, whose mother Mary had a house in Jerusalem, two-story house in Jerusalem. The church used it later on. Jesus sort of used it as the center of his own ongoings there in the city of Jerusalem. He used Mary's house. The disciples used Mary's house. They were there praying whenever Peter was in prison. More than likely, that was the house where they were in the upper room when the Holy Spirit came. There's no proof of that, but there was this house. It belonged to Mary, the mother of John Mark. And then John Mark had a cousin, Barnabas. He was a religious man. He had property in Cyprus, the island, sold it, gave it away to the poor. These were religious people. These people whom the Jewish leaders called ignoramuses, these people whom the Jewish people looked down upon as being this ignorant mob, a lot of those people were respectable people. They were good folks. The family of the blind man in John 9 were church-going people. They kept their mouth shut about how Jesus had opened the eyes of their son. They said, yes, he's our son, but ask him how his eyes were opened. He knows. He's old enough. He can talk for himself. And it says, John says, they said this because they were afraid they'd be put out of the synagogue. So these people were regular churchgoers. They were attenders of the synagogue, and they didn't want to jeopardize their membership. They were good, law-abiding, good kosher, good Orthodox Jewish people. And so was the man who was healed. Their son was one of those too. Because when he made his statement, when he finally came to the realization, hey, this something has happened to me that's very unique. And he had finally gotten up on his stump after saying, well, I don't know whether he's a sinner or not. And they said, well, what do you think about him? He said, well, he was a prophet. And then he goes on and says, and he finally ends up by saying, hey, if this man were not from God, he couldn't do anything. Listen to him. Listen to these people now. We hear these same people who are such know-it-alls. Here are the religious leaders. Watch them jump clear down this poor man's throat. When the man said, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Here they just said, you were born in utter sin. In other words, you were steeped in sin when you were born. How dare you lecture us? Whoo! How's that for just cutting you to pieces? Now look, the Jewish people are capable of that. The Jewish mamas, they'll cut their you. You better not cross a Jewish mama. She's got a tongue sharper than a Jewish daddy. You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they kicked him out. So he was one of those religious people. And for us, he becomes a bridge into this whole other segment of society that we're going to look at, that the New Testament calls sinners. A whole other segment of society. They're the outsider. And the man who was born blind and who was healed was now one of those outsiders. And so we'll use him as a bridge over into that other whole culture that represented, or that was represented by him and a lot of other people who were outsiders. They were ignored, they were avoided, and they were actually despised by the religious leaders as hopeless, as worthless, and as touchless. You dared not let even one of them touch you. You remember, we'll get to that in a few moments. But they felt like it was actually, would contaminate you if one of them touched you, or if you touched one of them. It was like being touched almost by a Gentile. And yet it was this segment of society that Jesus consistently and deliberately associated with that so infuriated the Jewish leaders. They could not stand it. And here's why. It represented a breakdown in the protection of the people against sin. It represented a breaking down of the wall of separation between the ones who were the insiders and the ones who were the outsiders. And it destroyed the peculiar identity that the Pharisees felt of being separate from other people who were sinners. And yet here comes this man Jesus, and he just hobnobs with all these people, and they loved him. And he touched them, and they touched him, and they drank together, and they ate together, and they went to parties together, and they went to the feasts together and wedding receptions. They did all this together. And the Pharisees were standing over there with their arms crossed, just watching him. And they would ask, what are you doing eating with sinners and publicans? And what are you doing over there? What are you eating with them? We're going to notice five different cases just in passing, and then we're going to draw a conclusion. Listen to this. And this ruined his reputation. When I say ruined it, it definitely tainted his reputation. He became known as something. The scriptures say he became known. And we're going to hold off. Think about it. What was it? He became known as the, and we'll come to it in just a moment, because it's the best news us sinners have ever had given us. It's the best piece of gossip. It's the best, juiciest piece of gossip that ever crossed the ears of lost humanity. Well, there were about five of these events. One in Matthew, the 9th chapter, verses 9 through 13. The call of Matthew Levi, was a tax collector. He was a traitor. They hated him. He was a traitor to the Jewish nation because he was collecting taxes from them and giving it to their despised Roman occupants or occupiers of their land. And that's their job. And they were known for taking the cream off the top and giving the Romans what they demanded and keeping all the rest for themselves. And some of them, it was justified. Some of them were thieves. And they were extortionists. I don't know about Matthew. Jesus chose him, though, out of that rank of the sinners and said, come on, I want you to follow me. I want you to be with me. Now, whenever Matthew was called, it's in Matthew the ninth chapter. If you want to turn there just real quickly, Matthew 9, we find after the call of Matthew, Matthew was so, he wanted everybody to know it. He wanted everybody to know that Jesus had called him and that he had accepted it. And so he gave a great feast. Matthew 9, verses 9 through 13. Look here. And Jesus went on from there and saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came to eat with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? See, this was unheard of. This was a no-no. If you were going to be a religious person, you did not fraternize with people who were not religious people. Does that give us any indication? What's the practice? It's so easy to associate with people who are like us. It's so easy to be with people who are like us financially. They're like us emotionally, maybe. They're like us ethnically. They're like us in terms of religion. It's so easy. Jesus didn't do this. He was always coming down on the wrong side of the tracks. Forever. And it just absolutely irritated them to death. It infuriated them because it made them feel threatened that this one who claimed to know God would come down and take his abode and make it among people like that. But he gives his rationale here for his M.O. You know what is an M.O.? Huh? Mode of operation. And here, in this case, he gives his rationale, and what's that? He gives his the meaning or the reason for his mode of operation. Why was he doing this? And that's what they were asking. What is your purpose? Why are you doing this? And listen to what he said. He said it's the sick, what, who have need of a physician, not the well. Do you see what he did? He caught them with a hook they couldn't get out of. They were asking him, why are you over there with those sick people instead of over here with us well people? That was the question. He said, well, it's the sick that need the physician, not you well people. That makes sense. So he caught them in their own trap. He sprung it and caught them and had to let them, and they had to admit, well, you know, that does make sense. The physician goes to sick people instead of the well people. So he absolutely disemboweled their criticism. And then he says, I came to call not righteous people, but sick people, but sinners to repentance. There's another example over in Luke, the 19th chapter, in the house of Zacchaeus, who went up the tree, you know, the tax collector in Jericho. He climbed the tree there, and Jesus saw him, and he said, Zacchaeus, come down. I've got to eat with you today. I've got to stay at your house. And as the people were gossiping, and they were saying under their breath, this man's gone in. He's gone in to be the guest of a man that's a sinner. This was the crowd of Jewish people going up to the temple. They had been infected by the same blindness of their leaders. And they said, he's gone in to be the guest of a man that's a sinner. And Jesus, in a sense, you almost get the impression with his arm around Zacchaeus and them walking into the house, him saying over his shoulder, well, this man's a son of Abraham too. For I've come to seek and save what? That which is lost. So here in this interaction in regard to Jesus' association with the tax collectors, here's his rationale for why he was with them. Number one, he said, the physician goes to the sick, not to the well. He said, I've come to call the sinners, not the righteous. This man's the son of Abraham too, and I've come to seek and save the lost. That's his rationale. That's why he did what he did. And that's why he would not back down. This was the way he was doing it. Now, look again at another one. You remember the woman taken in adultery? In John the 8th chapter, the woman taken in adultery that they brought and said this woman was caught in the act of adultery, in the very act. We caught her. Moses says to stone her. What do you say? Watch Jesus as he agrees. He agrees with them. Jesus doesn't disagree with the law. He doesn't disagree with the accusation of these people. Jesus, in essence, says, okay, you're right. Now, the one that's without sin among you, let him throw the first stone. And he could have just stabbed them down. But you know what? He didn't. He stooped down again and wrote on the sand and let them get away without anybody, without him glaring at them. And he just let their own conscience work on them and let them know. And you could just almost see them saying, go ahead, throw it, and I'll throw the second one. No, you throw it, and I'll throw the second one. And they never could get anybody to throw the first stone. Because everybody knew that everybody there was a sinner. And it may very well be that the very men that brought her in had set the thing up and that they knew this woman too well. And it may very well have been implying, which of you men have not been with her? Or, where is the man that was caught in this act? If it was in the act of adultery, where is the man? And so he just simply said, well, okay, let him that's without sin cast the first stone. There's another one. In Luke, the 15th chapter, verses 1 and 2, it says, now tax collectors and sinners were gathering around Jesus to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Oh, this man welcomes sinners and he eats with them. And that was such an abomination to these men. And they wanted to know why. And that's on this classic occasion when Jesus told these three great stories. The story of the lost coin, the lost sheep, and the lost boy. We won't have time to go. You know the story. But what was he doing? Why did he tell these three parables, all of them with the same theme, that something had been lost and something had been found? A coin and a sheep and a boy. And there was absolute jubilation over the lost sheep. There was absolute joy over the lost coin. And there was unrestrained gladness over this lost son coming home. What was his point? The point Jesus was making is, this is the way God looks at sinners who come home. You're asking me why I'm doing what I'm doing and why I'm with these people. You're asking me why I'm out here with them. It's because that's the way God looks at them. I'm showing you what God looks at sinners like. And I'm showing you how God treats sinners who come back to him. And that's the way, and he said, that's why I'm treating them like this. Because you see here once again, they didn't understand God. Jesus did. And he says, I'm telling you, God looks at a returning sinner. And in verse 10 of that chapter he says, there is joy in heaven over one sinner who repents. Just one is all it takes to start the angels doing flips and didos. And somebody said there are angel feathers all over the throne room every time a sinner comes home. Just doing flips and dados. Angels going, yes, another one. And the Father going, good, good. That's great. That's wonderful. And all this. And these old sourpusses. Look at the difference. Look at the difference. Over there weaned on a dill pickle, you know. Religion had made them so. God's not an ugh God. God is a joyful God. And Jesus came to show what God was like. Oh, man. That's such good news. There's a third or a fourth one, and that's in Luke, the 7th chapter, verses 36 through 50. The sinful woman and Simon. Simon the Pharisee's house, he was entertaining Jesus. And this is the most detailed picture of this gulf between the way the Pharisees looked at sinners and the way God looks at sinners. And you know the story. The woman came in. I don't know where she came from. I think personally that she was the woman from John 8. That's just a supposition of mine. I love to think of her as coming after having been forgiven of the sin, after having all of her accusers just kind of melt away, and she was left there standing before Jesus, and he said, dear lady, did nobody condemn you? And she said, no, sir, no one. And listen to this. Then he said, neither do I condemn you. Go on and leave your life of sin. And there she was, a free person. She was doomed to be stoned. If you were caught sinning, if you were caught committing adultery, you were to be stoned. He had given her back her life. And there she stood, completely free. I get the impression that she gathered the sheet up around her, because that may have been all she had on her. She gathered the sheet up around her and she said, who was that? And they may have said, well, that was Jesus of Nazareth. He just gave you back your life. She said, I know that. Do you know where I can find him? They said, well, I heard Simon the Pharisee ask him home to dinner. Do you know where Simon lived? They said, yeah, number 9 Jericho Road. And I can see her grab that sheet and just take off at number 9 Jericho Road. And she bursts in and finds him, sees him over there, and she goes down and kneels down against all protocol. She was not invited. Who cared? There was more at stake than protocol. And she knelt down and just began to bawl. And her tears fell on his feet, and she wiped them with her hair, which means that it had to be taken down. And for a woman to have her hair down was a shame in the Jewish society. But there again, she simply disassociated herself with anything that was decor or proper. And she wept on his feet and wiped them with her hair and began to kiss them. And then she put some ointment, some perfume that she carried, and she put it on his feet. What a difference you see as she wept her heart out. And then look at the difference. Look at this other. Look at him over there saying, uh-huh. Yeah, that settles it for me. If he were a prophet, he'd know what kind of a woman this is that's touching him, that she's a sinner. What a difference between Simon and this woman. That's why it stung so. Listen. Every time they attacked Jesus on this issue of being with sinners, you know what happened? They came away burned and embarrassed. Burned and embarrassed. They came away having been painted into a corner, having no way to escape, having to just simply scoot away, hoping nobody would see them. They came away burned and embarrassed, and then this is why it so hurt them. When he leveled this accusation against them, he said, tax collectors and prostitutes go into the kingdom of God before you do. Talking to these religious leaders. Tax collectors and prostitutes going into the kingdom before you do. And that was just another nail in his coffin. They couldn't stand him. They hated him. In John's gospel, toward the end of his life, the last 2 or 3 days of his life, he makes this mournful admission. If I had not come and spoken to them, they wouldn't have sinned. Then he said, if I had not come and done among them the things that nobody else did, they wouldn't have had sin. But now they have both seen and hated me and my Father. And they knew he had to go. They knew that he had to go. He could not be allowed to continue. And they made their plans to assassinate him.